And if you haven't been danced out already, don't worry, there's going to be a bit of Scottish or Irish dancing, Kaylee, coming up in just a moment. But I thought it'd be good to think through why we're doing this. Why are we dancing? It's great fun, but why have we changed the evening service into a dance hall for tonight? Well, throughout the Bible, we see many occasions of dancing as a way of celebrating great news. Can you think through the Exodus? After the Exodus, the people of Israel crossed the Red Sea, they triumphed over their enemies, and Miriam and the ladies of Israel led people in the dance to celebrate this victory. Or you can think about the time of the judges and of the kings. The king, the hero, would go out to fight the enemy. They'd go out, and when they returned victorious, there'd be time of feasting, celebrating, and dancing. Think through what that meant for the village at the time. Israel was surrounded by lots of enemies. They wanted to destroy the Israelite nation, and the king would arise, the hero would arise. They would go out, and there'd be no news. There was no telephone. You couldn't find out what was happening on the front line. You don't know what was going on. And then wonderfully, the news came back. The hero returned victorious, and there was peace. There was celebration. There was dancing going on. And that's a little bit like what's going on at Easter. On Easter, on Good Friday, Jesus, our hero, goes out and accomplishes a great victory. On Saturday, he's in the tomb. We don't know what's happened. Then gloriously on Sunday, he emerges victorious. And throughout the last so, Christians have used this time of year to celebrate the good news of what Jesus accomplished. Let's have a think through what it is that he accomplished that night. I've got a little bit of the Bible printed out on these cards. I hope you've all got one near you. This is, apart from the Gospel of John, John was an eyewitness of Jesus, and John wrote down the things that he saw about Jesus so that we might know the truth of all that happened. Let me read these words to you. A week later, Jesus' disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you've seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." We're halfway through a story here. It's a week later. This is a week after that first Easter Sunday. On that first day, Mary and Magdalene rose early. They went to the tomb and discovered to their surprise that the tomb was empty. They didn't know what was going on. They ran and told Peter and John. Peter and John ran to the tomb to investigate. They discovered it was empty. They didn't fully understand what was going on. They came back puzzled. Oh, no doubt talking about it. No doubt confused. And wonderfully, that first Easter evening, Jesus appeared among them. And he said, "Peace be with you." Unfortunately, one of the disciples, Thomas, wasn't there to see what had happened. And when Thomas turned up later, we don't know why he wasn't there. When he turned up later, the disciples said to him, "We've seen Jesus. Jesus has appeared to us." And Thomas just mocks it. He says, "Unless I see the scars, unless I touch the scars and put my hand in his side, I will not believe." Well, that week went by. We don't quite know the relationships that was going on at that time, the confusion, the puzzlement, the tension. But that week passed. And Jesus again appeared among them. This time Thomas was there. And look at what Jesus offers his disciples. It's there in verse 26, at the end of verse 26. Jesus says, "Peace be with you." In a sense, in a superficial way, Jesus is aware his disciples are scared. They've got the doors locked. They don't know what's going on. And to some degree, Jesus is just offering what they need. In a time of trouble, Jesus offers peace. But of course, we've seen in the book of John in the last couple of weeks that when John writes, he's got multiple meanings going on, depths going on that we often don't see. At that time, there was a great hope from the Hebrew Scriptures, from the Old Testament, of a coming time of peace when everything that was wrong would be put right. Everything that should be, would be. That was the great promise. That was the great hope that was going on. So there was peace with others. That was the promise. If you put five children together with five identical toys, pretty soon there will be no peace. One child will want to have that toy, which is identical to this toy in every single way, other than the fact that it's being played by with that child. And as adults, we're no different. We sometimes hide the jealousy that we have. We can sometimes pretend we're okay. But at heart, we know that there are times of envy, times of jealousy, times of strife with each other. And of course, that works out on a macro scale as well. When nations go to war, that's just happening at a national scale. What is going on in my heart? What's going on in your heart? And the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, promised a time of peace when relationships would be right. Not a fake peace like we see in the world around us when two countries cease to be at war, but a real peace where there's harmony between each other. Not only peace between each other, a peace between the world and mankind. A time where there'd be a great abundance of food, where the world would produce the goods, that the food that people were needing. And most importantly, peace with God. Not a grudging acceptance that God exists, not a grudging willingness to put up with God, but deep peace, knowing God, knowing and being known by Him. I don't know if you've ever had the privilege of having friends who are great experts in some obscure branch of science or whatever. It's great fun just asking them the questions and asking them about this aspect and this aspect. Could you imagine what it's like to be friends, to have peace with God? The one who made the stars, to be able to talk to him about the stars that he made, the stars that he named. Wouldn't that be awesome? That's the peace that was being offered by the Hebrew Scriptures. And if you see this song, this is really helpful, I Haven't Loved Enough, you see a sense of that longing, a longing for the time when everything that should be, will be. And that was the peace that the Old Testament Scriptures were looking forward to. And that's the peace that we see in the life of Jesus. Jesus lived a perfect life. He perfectly coped and integrated with others. He accepted the outsider. Everything about him showed that he was God living the perfect life, the life of peace, where the creation was able to provide the food that was needed. We see that peace in the life of Jesus. And we see it now offered to Thomas and the disciples. Jesus is offering a time where everything that should be, will be. He's offering us peace. And notice how he offers it, verse 27. He offers it through his wounds, through his suffering. Verse 27, then Jesus said to Thomas, put your fingers here, see my hands, reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Jesus is, of course, referring to the wound marks he suffered on the cross, the nail marks that went through his hands and his feet, the spear that went into his side. Now, in some ways, it's obvious he's picking up Thomas's comment, but that superficial reading doesn't quite make sense of everything. What is Jesus doing? Is Jesus taking Thomas too literally? Is he really thinking Thomas could only believe that Jesus rose from the dead if he literally did touch the wounds? Is he making some sort of sick joke, as if he's saying to Thomas, I know exactly what you thought, you better come and do this. If you think this isn't exactly the sort of thing that's going to produce peace, if you manage to, over the next 3 years, create a following of disciples who are committed to you, follow after you, you die some horrible death, and 3 days later you rise again from the dead, my top tip to you is don't offer peace by showing the wounds. That's going to scare the... That's going to scare your disciples. But why is Jesus insistent on showing the wounds? It's because it's through the wounds that there is peace. Early on, the week before, Jesus appeared to the other disciples. He proclaimed, peace be with you. He showed them his wounds. And again, peace be with you. In John's mind, the peace and the wounds are deeply connected. What's going on? Well, it's this, that on the cross, everything that should not be, but is, happened to Jesus. On the cross, everything thing that should not be, but is, happened to Jesus. Think about physical suffering in the world. God made the world that we should not suffer, but there's so much suffering around us. On the cross, Jesus suffered physically. Think about shame and disgrace. God made us as humans to have dignity, to have honor, to have glory. And yet so often our life is characterized by shame and disgrace. And on the cross, Jesus hung there naked, suffering shame and disgrace. Think about abandonment by friends or loneliness. Maybe in Beijing you're particularly aware of that loneliness. God made us in his image to be relational people, to love one another, to be in relationship with each other. And it's so hard when those relationships get broken. And Jesus on the cross suffered those broken relationships. He suffered abandonment. He suffered loneliness. Never was anyone more lonely than Jesus when he was on the cross. Think about injustice. God is a God of justice. He created the world that there might be justice. But Jesus suffered injustice in the fake trial, put to death. He suffered racism on the sign above the cross. The king of the Jews, Pilate, mocking the Jewish nation for what he was doing. And most of all, he suffered the broken relationship with God. We've turned our back on God. We don't really want to follow his ways. We like to do things our own way. And to some extent, God says, let it be. He turns our back on us. And he lets us go in the way that we want to go. And that is a terrifying thought. God is the author of life. He's the source of goodness, of light. And if he turns his back on us, we are in darkness and we suffer death. On the cross, everything that should not be but is was endured by Jesus so that we could have peace. We could have the experience that everything that should be would one day be ours. But how's that received? Well, verse 27. Jesus says, stop doubting. The end of verse 27. Stop doubting and believe. We receive this peace through faith. But what does faith look like? Faith means so many different things to lots of other people. Well, John helps us to know what faith means by looking at verse 28. Thomas said to Jesus, my Lord and my God. What's going on in that statement? There's two different things. We can think about it in relationship. What does it mean in terms of God? What does it mean in terms of Thomas? First thing it means, Jesus is objectively Lord and God. And Thomas is changing his views to fit into reality. That's one thing it means. And the other thing is the realization that Jesus is Lord and God for us and for our goodness. Throughout the book of John, Jesus has demonstrated that he is God. When we think of the word God, it means many, many different things to many different people. If you were a Viking living in Norway, going out on pillaging, you think of the word God and you think of a man with a great big hammer who was busy in thunderstorms or whatever. God means many different things, but Jesus reveals to us what God is like. And what does this God look like? Well, in the book of John, we see his work in creation. We see his work in giving life. In the book of John, right at the beginning, we're told that Jesus is the one through whom all things were created. We see his work over creation in creating the 600 litres of wine at that wedding in Cana. We see his work in creation in feeding 5,000 people with just 12 loaves and leaving with 12 baskets full over. We see his work in creation. It's a good creation. It's a super abundant creation God is doing. What Jesus is like, that's what God is like. He's the creator of all things, good and overgenerous. We see him in his life. 2 weeks ago, we looked at Jesus raising Lazarus to life. We see that Jesus approaches death, and he's got the power to raise someone from death, just as if they were asleep. We see that God is the source of life. He is a fountain of life that springs forth, giving life to other people. We tend to think that the good life is somehow over here, and God is somehow over there, trying to destroy this good life. If there's something fun, God is going to come in with a command to stop it. That's our natural view of God. But in John, we see that God is the source of all of life, all the goodness. Everything that we enjoy in life, everything that is good, comes from Him. And what happens when we turn away from God? We turn away from the source of life. And the end result is eventually death and darkness in the world. But amazingly, on Easter, on Good Friday, death itself, the source of life, was cut off. But you cannot destroy the fountain of life. And Jesus conquered death through His life, the resurrection. He's demonstrated He is God. He's demonstrated He is Lord. He's Lord over creation. He is Lord over all things. In some way, the word Lord simply means boss. But we think of that in terms of a God who gives rules that spoil our fun, who destroy the things we do. That's because we don't understand who God is. God is the source of life. He's the source of goodness. If you like, as we were dancing, it is the caller giving us rules, and as we follow those rules, the fun of the dance emerges. That's the sort of God that God is. He's ruler who gives life, who gives good things to each one of us. And He's Lord, and something even more profound in the context of John. He is the Lord. He is the Adonai, the Hashem, the God who appeared to Abraham, the God who appeared to Moses, the God who appeared to Isaac, the God who came down and helped His people in the Old Testament, is the God who came down, became a man, and lived and died for us. And John has presented this. This is reality. Jesus is God. He is Lord. And Thomas is turning his direction so that his views are in line with reality. He confesses, Jesus is my Lord. He is my God. Secondly, my Lord and my God. What does it mean? Well, it's to acknowledge He is Lord and God for me. It's one thing to say that Jesus' death deals with what shouldn't be. It's one thing to say that in His peace He can give us what should be. But it's much more to say that in His death He dealt with what shouldn't be. That's inside of me. In His life, He gives us what should be for me. Later on in the Bible, we see these words. I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave Himself for me. Thomas, looking at the wounds of Jesus, realized this. He realized it was because of his sins Jesus had to die. He looked at the wounds, he realized it was because of Jesus' love for him, Jesus chose to die. And it was because of Jesus' love for Thomas that he came to new life and gave Thomas life. That's what it means to say, my Lord and my God, to know it was my sins that put Jesus on the cross. It was his love for me that made him willing to die there. It was his willingness to give me life that caused him to rise from the dead. If I was the only person in the whole universe, my sins would be so great that Jesus had to die for me. And yet his love is so great that he is willing to die for me. And in his life he offers peace to me. Jesus is my Lord. He is my God. And so Thomas, looking at the scars, praises Jesus. You did this for me, my Lord and my God. So there is Jesus. He's offering peace. It's offered through his wounds. It's received through faith in him. Well, what about us now? Verse 29. Then Jesus told him, because you've seen me, you have not believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. We obviously belong in that category of those who have not seen the resurrection of Jesus. I have not seen Jesus raised to life. We belong in that category. And in some way, that is a blessing to us. I don't know if you've ever been to the cinema, to a widescreen cinema, and you've made the foolish choice to sit right on the front row in the middle. And you can see something yellow is happening. And you're struggling to see, and you can see sort of up there, and you can just about work out the yellow is a car, and it's doing something. That was the perspective of Thomas and the disciples. They were right there in the action. It was all going on. It was very difficult to work out what was happening around them. We have the benefit of living at a distance. We can look back at the documents. We can look back at the writers of the Gospels. This is Matthew's account here. We can look back at John's account. We can make sense of what was going on. We can understand his miracles and what that shows us about Jesus. We live in a blessed era where we can make sense of things. And we can look at history. We can see what the resurrection life of Jesus did in history. We can see how Jesus' resurrection life changed scared disciples who were locked into a room to bold proclaimers of the faith. We can see how followers of Jesus generations later on were not afraid to meet death to testify of Jesus. Even in the last few weeks, we've seen the atrocities in Kenya, seen the atrocities elsewhere. Followers of Jesus, not afraid of death because they understand the resurrection of Jesus. And we have the blessings of Scripture. John goes on to say next, Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. We've got the Scriptures written down for us, giving us the evidence of who Jesus is, why he had to come down, why he had to die, why he had to rise to new life. What does it mean particularly for us? Well, I guess there's different groups within this room. Most of us are Christians. Most of us accept these truths. Most of us understand who Jesus is. But like the disciples, our faith is mixed with elements of doubt. Like the disciples, it's as if we're behind closed doors, as if we're scared. And Jesus says this, the story goes, that there's no doors so strong that Jesus cannot come in. And there's no fear so great that Jesus can't come in to bring peace. Every fear that we share in some way relates to the fear of death and the fear of being separated from God. At the cross, Jesus dealt with the reign of sin, and in his resurrection, he destroyed the power of death. There is no darkness so great that Christ cannot enter and give you light. There is no sin so deep that he cannot enter and give you forgiveness and peace. And so if you're a Christian, if you're struggling with fears or doubts or whatever, hear Jesus' gracious words to you. Stop doubting and believe. Peace is offered. Enjoy that peace this Easter and beyond. Of course, some of us maybe here for the very first time, we've never really heard anything about Christian. We've never heard this sort of statement about Jesus. And it's all very confusing. But Jesus is saying, because of the resurrection, we can know peace. The Bible picture of Jesus is so much greater, so much more wonderful than we can ever imagine, so much greater than his disciples can ever portray. Speaking to someone the other day who, when he read the Bible for the first time, he was absolutely amazed by this portrayal of Jesus. He thought Jesus would just be a good teacher, telling people how to live, what they should do. And he was absolutely astounded by the power and authority he found in Jesus. That may be you. You're puzzled. May I encourage you to read one of the eyewitness accounts of Jesus and to know what he said, what he's really like. Take the first-hand evidence for yourself and examine it and see for yourself. But for others, you know that this is true. You know that Jesus has risen from the dead. You know that he offers peace. But Thomas, you've not yet received that peace. Well, Jesus' words apply to you just as much. Stop doubting and believe. Jesus is Lord, he is God. Let's change our attitude so we conform to the truth that is evident in the universe. Jesus is Lord, he is God. Let's receive the benefits and know that he died for you, he died for me, he rose for you, and he rose for me.
Father, we thank you so much for the resurrection of Jesus. Thank you that he came, he died for us, he rose again, and he gives new life to us. Thank you that we can enjoy that life in part now, and thank you one day we will enjoy that life completely and fully in him. We thank you for your blessings to us. Amen.